Welcome to Letters Read, the ongoing series of readings from archives, special collections, and other materials like faxes, text messages, stuff literally from the street. Antenna is the project's fiscal partner. I'm Chris Kamenstein, co-artistic director of Goat in the Road Productions, executive advisory board member of Letters Read and MC. Nancy Sharon Collins is Letters Read director.
Evening. This program heavily relies on Susan Tucker and Beth Willinger's fantastic scholarship and superb online project, The Letters of Josephine Louise Newcomb, comprising approximately 130 letters and four bound volumes of legal documents germane to the Newcomb story. Available online through the Letters of Josephine Louise Newcomb website, just Google it. This is a complex story. With the help of writer-researcher Jared Lofsted, who did the heavy sifting through primary source material, I edited this narrative, which is being recorded for podcasting.
This evening, we read about Josephine Louise Joe Newcomb and the founding of H. Sophie Newcomb Memorial College, an institution established with Joe's money to memorialize her daughter, who passed away at 15, not long after the death of her dad, Joe's husband, Warren Newcomb. The college's original mission, Joe's mission, was as a safe space to educate women, only women, white women. This changed in 1962, and the first black student entered in 63. If Joe's benevolence was not enough founded in grief after the rapid-fire death of her husband and her only child, a rift occurred between Joe and her elder sister, Ellen Henderson. Ellen was Joe's only sibling. Allow me to introduce Shadow Angelina Starkey, reading as Joe, and in Act Two, Robert Valley, as Michael C. McCarthy. It is 1866, after Joe's husband has died. Shadow.
Act One.
October 7th. Dear Ellen, I went out with Sophie for her walk this evening, as I daily do, and go and sit in the squares. How sad it is for us to see so many roll past, may they long enjoy. Then it is my swelling heart takes me to Greenwood Cemetery, there he lies forever from me, and all that he enjoyed is so lost to us. Sophie took my hand the other evening and with weeping eyes said, Mama, it is hard, very hard to think Papa has gone from us, but God's will be done. At times, she fully realizes her heavy loss, but says her godfather will take care of her. Dear sister, you ask me if I will join you. I answer as Ruth did Naomi. I will go with you, and thy children shall be my children, but I fear for my lasting strength. It is being so sadly taxed.
November 5th, 1866, following a visit from William, Ellen's husband, who Sophie referred to as godfather.
Dear sister, William told me of a school in Dresden that he thinks was very superior, and I value his judgment and opinion very highly. There is no sacrifice I would not make to have my child, a true, noble, cultivated woman, loved and respected among her sex and an ornament to society.
She continues.
Now, my dear sister, may I intrude upon your affectionate confidence to ask you, why are your spirits dejected? As you say, my mind is so worried. What is it distresses you? If I am sure you have enough to make you comfortable, and even to give you luxuries and blessed with three devoted sons, who would each one study and look after your happiness and interests and keep everything private and within themselves, while I have no one but strangers to go to, no loved, interested one to keep all things private and regard my feelings, think of me in my loneliness, and while it may not relieve you, it will, I know and feel, to excite your sympathy for me, as our nature is, to keep everything within ourselves.
The November letter also reflects the limited aspirations one could have for female children. To have my child a true, noble, cultivated woman, loved and respected among her sex, and an ornament to society. I have to say, as the father of a spunky girl myself, being an ornament to society is a very low bar. Shadow again with more letters from Joe to Ellen. Mr. M is one of the administrators of Warren's estate.
November 26th, 1866. For 3 weeks, my dear child and self walked to this city to find a suitable shelter for our heads. The Everett was hopeless, and I found what I had hoped would be agreeable and comfortable, but it proved to be a hornet's nest. However, I escaped with fewer stings than I expected. And through him who protects the widows and the orphan, I have found a haven of rest and peace, the only congenial one since you left me, as the gaiety of Fifth Avenue seemed a mockery to my feelings. Christmas, 1866. Having passed the morning thinking of my dear departed, I will finish the day with you and Willie, and should have answered you both ere this had I been able to do so. First, Sophie, with kisses, wishes you and all a merry and cheerful Christmas and many happy New Years. Your letter of the 9th I received after William's of the 11th. It is the last time, I assure you, I ever enter a boarding house, and can attribute my engaging them only to mental abstraction. In telling me to deny yourself nothing, please practice it yourself. For remember, should misfortune attack you, you have 3 affectionate, devoted sons of age, while I have only a tender child.
She continues.
I attend with Sophie to all my own affairs, my banking business and accounts, collecting all bills, paying all expenses, and rendering Mr. M a monthly account. Mr. M said I should keep Sophie's expenses separate, as I was not expected to pay anything for her, which, after he left, affected her very much.
Josephine Louise Lemonnier Newcomb. Who was she? Slight, soft-spoken, somewhat shy. She grew up in Baltimore, extended family all living near. The men were sea captains, flour, and French fancy goods merchants / importers. Jo's letters tell us that her mother died when she was 15. Her father was employed by her mom's family, and Jo lived with her father, brother, who died young, sister Ellen, and Ellen's husband in New Orleans and Louisville. In Louisville, she marries Warren Newcomb. Jo and Warren spend their lives back and forth between New Orleans, Louisville, and New York. Baltimore is also mentioned in her letters. Jo never lived in her own home, residing in hotels and stays with relatives, a not uncommon mode of living for the well-to-do in the Victorian era. In 1855, daughter Sophie is born. During the American Civil War, they live in New York City in France. Back in New York City, 1866, Warren dies of cirrhosis of the liver, leaving Jo a wealthy estate.
While Jo was accustomed to moving frequently, grieving made her anxious and even more unsettled.
Rarely did she live in one place for more than a few months and never felt completely comfortable in polite society. She was a wealthy single Southern lady living much of her time in the North soon after the Civil War. Dealing with life on her own, a single mother with child, with finding suitable living conditions and navigating social engagement, she found solace through written correspondence, her letters, with intimates and family. Challenges for any woman of the time were: a woman was not supposed to go out of the home without a male escort. They couldn't vote. It was nearly impossible for a woman to get a loan unless a male co-signed or was part of the deal. With ease, a husband or family member could have a woman institutionalized. Female hysteria was readily diagnosed as a medical condition, explaining away behaviors and symptoms that made men uncomfortable. Shadow again as Jo writing to Ellen with trouble she'd encountered, surprised that Warren's estate managers had risen to her defense.
May 6th, 1867. Your kind and affectionate letter, my dear sister Ellen, of April 23rd has been received and contents carefully noted. I would like to reply in full, as I want to, but am in too much trouble at present to even write you this little. I wrote Brother William. Mr. M. and Mr. H. were true friends, in which they defended me on some unkind remarks that were made on my character, and must say their defense of me astonished me very much, as they've never given me any comfort, exercised any interest, or expressed any sympathy for me. Except Mr. H.
Early in her widowhood, Jo heavily relied on Ellen and her family for emotional support. For obvious reasons, Jo turned to male members of Ellen's family for legal and financial guidance. Remember, at that time, only guys could trade money and approach the law. From Barnum's Hotel, January 28, 1868, asking Ellen's husband for advice.
Dear Brother William, yesterday, remembering your kind words on parting, that my child should never want a father or mother's care while you and my sister lived, and you both being selected by her father as her second parents, it is in her interest now I wish to advise with you about, and would like you to see all of my correspondence, but that would make it a large package. I have but just received the first remittance for Sophie, as you will see by the enclosed letters, and there is no necessity for me to touch it, and what shall I do with it? I think 4% is little to get for her. EDM and Company has desired a loan of me at 6%, making it $200 more a year than I get at Trust and Company at 4%. But I have nothing, for the reasons of my head and mind have been in such a state I have not been allowed to write. Sophie is learning all I think she should at her age. I object to her being put in algebra. I have taken the best advice regarding having taught her music without any ear or taste, and I'm told it would be a waste of labor, time, and expense for the present. It may be a waste of labor, time, and expense. It may be a little later developed in her, like the brilliant genius of some of our greatest men. I also send for you all to see how she has grown. A picture of her requested by me by her teacher just after taking a walk, and as it was desired. Please let me hear from you by return mail fully, and send the picture. You will also see the first check and signatures. With our love to you.
Act 2. May 6, 1870, Ellen's husband William, who had been ill, dies.
December 9, the same year, Sophie is diagnosed with diphtheria. In great distress, Sophie cries, "Mama, take me on your lap, Mama! How dark it is." A week later, Sophie dies. Joe sends for Ellen, and immediately Ellen leaves to be with her grieving sister.
Ellen's journey is impaired by a snowstorm delaying her arrival and Sophie's funeral. Finally in New York, Joe and Ellen, sisters and widows, are together. They attend to Sophie's burial. January 10, 1871, Joe and Ellen leave New York for New Orleans. Arriving at the Henderson residence, 1351 Magazine Street, Joe did not stay long. From court testimony, we learn that, while in New York, Mrs. Newcomb gave her sister $50,000, and on January 9, 1871, gave written orders to her confidential agent, Solon Humphrey, to sell enough of her securities to realize $100,000 and to send checks for $25,000 each to her nephews William, Warren, and Howard Henderson, and her niece, Victorine McCarthy. The check for William Henderson was sent to him at Louisville, Kentucky. The checks for Warren and Howard Henderson and Victorine McCarthy were sent addressed to Mrs. Newcomb in care of Mr. McCarthy's firm in New Orleans, with instructions that it be opened only by Mrs. Newcomb. The letter reached New Orleans after Mrs. Newcomb had left. It was opened by her sister, and the checks delivered by her to her children, Warren, Howard Henderson, and Victorine McCarthy, respectively.
Around this time, in deep mourning, searching for purpose, Joe begins designating portions of her money to be donated to civic and educational institutions. In her words, to memorialize, quote, "my beloved husband and darling child," close quote.
Also at this time, during Joe's visit with Ellen and her family, something happened. The family fabric begins to tear. A rend develops.
From Henderson v. Newcomb Estate, Appellate Division. Testimony of Michael McCarthy, Volume 2, pages 497 to 517. February 7, 1903. With regard to that carriage ride, I have stated that I passed certain places that were known, well-known parties. I knew there were parties that were known to Mrs. Henderson, and I presume some of them to Mrs. Newcomb. I presume Mrs. Tilton was known to Mrs. Newcomb. I suppose the Denegs were, and the Stauffers. It was not likely that the two sisters knew them alike, because one left New Orleans in 1845, and the other left in 1872. I don't know about her intimacy with Mrs. Hawkins. They were people who lived in many years in New Orleans. I was conversing about these matters in the carriage. I would be driving along and say, "Mr. Jones lives here, and Mr. Thompson lives there, and Mr. Smith and Brown." As we passed these residences, her sister would make remarks about, "That is the residence of Mr. So-and-so." They were talking of friends and where people lived, and the sister would say to her sister, "Now this is where Mrs. So-and-so lives," and so, and so, and they would talk about old times. Of course, they were much prior to my knowledge of all these people, because I had only a society knowledge of them. I sometimes also joined in the conversation. That drive extended out Canal Street to where the Hotel Dieu was. We did not go one step further. The dust was so great, we returned. The Hotel Dieu was a charitable institution, and most all the eminent physicians of New Orleans attended the sick there. Speaking of the doctors, we passed Dr. Stone's house, and the conversation arose. She said she knew Mrs. Dr. Stone, and then that theme of the Hotel Dieu came up, and they were speaking about it and this Dr. Smythe she had known or heard of in former years. He was attached to the Hotel Dieu, I think he was then. Mrs. Newcomb wanted to know the faculty, the names of the faculty, and the people, and the doctors, and those names were mentioned. Mrs. Henderson mentioned Dr. Stone, and I think there was a Dr. Jonas. Several physicians of New Orleans, I mentioned some. I think I might have mentioned the names after they had mentioned them. I think I mentioned Dr. Stone, they mentioned Stone. It was just a joint conversation, just three. We did not go further than the Hotel Dieu because the ride was as much as they wanted to take, and then it was very dusty. They were heavily veiled in deep mourning, and the dust was so great and got all over their clothing, their veils, and everything that we returned as she wanted to see the other side of Canal Street. And as she came back in the shopping districts and the stores that she, Mrs. Newcomb, and Mrs. Henderson had shopped in years ago. It was a warm day, rather. You know the weather in New Orleans.
You know, sometimes when you get that feeling in the pit of your stomach that something's terribly not right, Joe left New Orleans shortly after that ride.
February 13, 1871, the administrator of Warren's estate sends Joe a letter confirming the gifts to her sister's family had been initiated. As per Joe's instructions, the letter was sent care of Michael McCarthy's law firm to Mrs. J. L. Newcomb, care of Stewart and McCarthy. "My dear Mrs. Newcomb, I enclose three checks on the United States Trust Company in accordance with your letter of instructions, January 9th. I also enclose the receipts for each of them to sign when you hand them the checks and which return to be my mail. The amount for Mr. William H. Henderson, I will tomorrow send to him at Louisville. All well, very truly your friend, Solon Humphreys."
By then, Joe'd gone. I read a letter from Ellen to Joe, sent from New Orleans, February 23, 1871. "My dear sister, a few days after your departure from here, I received from my son Willie a telegram announcing the receipt of your kind donation to him. And the day following, I received a big letter for you, which I supposed would contain a donation to your other godchildren at home with me. Acting from the news of the telegram, I opened and found the papers for my other children, which I handed them in your name. I cannot express to you, my dear sister, how pleased and thankful they are. As soon as possible, they will acknowledge to you their heartfelt thanks. The gifts were checks on United States Trust Company, New York, which they sent to be collected."
The Wren becomes a rift. From testimony, Shadow paraphrases a letter dated March 27, 1871, in which Joe wrote to Michael C. McCarthy, her sister's son-in-law, in which she
advised and requested Michael and my nephew W.N. Henderson before a witness to return all letters received by him, McCarthy, and addressed to the care of McCarthy's house, and that the opening of my letters is a serious matter and in New York a criminal offense.
Joe broke off correspondence with Ellen. The rift was final.
Act 3. To lose a husband, only child, and then estrangement from an only sibling, Joe's grief must have been profound. Shadow reads a letter the following year to one of her confidants, Amelia Louisa Howard, a maternal cousin.
"Christmas, 1873. My good Louisa, I have your letter of the 16th, so grateful and so kind to think of that darling in heaven. Oh, Louisa, how she did love you, And often before her death has she spoken of you, and we could not wonder where you were or what had become of you, and when I think how near you were to us. And she should die without you seeing her or knowing of it. I weep more, as she would have been so happy to have seen you before she died. Oh, Louisa, I scarcely do anything but cry. My sufferings are untold, but the Lord's will must be accepted, and I must patiently wait his time to call me. I thought of you the day you wrote me, and perhaps at the time and hour you were writing me, I was dressing her marble cross with flowers and wished for you beside me as I was all alone. But 'tis God's will. I went over yesterday to dress all the graves for Christmas, on dear Mr. Newcomb's a cross, on little Warren a wreath, on my loved parents a crown, on my brothers a cross and anchor, and on the gate, under that hallowed name, Warren Newcomb, a handsome evergreen wreath. And all looked beautiful, and how we would have wept together. Pray for me, Louise. I fear I shall never see you again. As everyone is astonished how I live at all, they would be more so if they could feel my breaking heart. Try and make your children happy this joyful day. From your friend, Mrs. W. M. Newcomb.
Though the two sisters had once been very close, evidence of this great rift is found in the four bound volumes mentioned at the beginning of this reading. The volumes contain copies of three court cases in which Joe's nephews, nieces, grandnephews, and nieces contest Joe's last will and testament, attempting to force the return to them of the money given to Tulane for Newcomb College. How? By proving she was not right in her head and that she was, and the will was not legal. Ellen's descendants had good reason to be grabby. At the time of her death in 1901, Joe's endowment to Newcomb totaled approximately $3.6 million, worth over $130 million today. From 1871 to 1892, the court described Joe as near the condition of a person without a home and domicile as it is possible in law for a person to be. Referee's Opinion, Volume Number 1. She must have felt very much alone and betrayed by her own family. Ellen's family tried three times in court, lost every time.
Well, what brought Joe out of an obviously downward spiral? Purpose? This new pattern she made with contributions to institutions such as Fordham, Washington and Lee Universities, to St. Anna's in New Orleans, and education money given to friends so their children could be educated.
In 1886, Joe sent a letter of endowment and $100,000 to Tulane University for the creation of a women's college. In 1887, H. Sophie Newcomb Memorial College was born, a real college, not a two-year school for girls prevalent at that time. Newcomb was the first degree-granting coordinate college for women in the United States, thus creating the safe place for women to be educated that Joe had wanted.
It took a while, but eventually, Joe began returning to New Orleans. The rift with Ellen must have hurt like hell. The memory of that carriage ride, the veiled threat, and what it represented lingered.
In 1892, Joe began visiting the college, sometimes even staying in the dorm, getting to know faculty and students, taking personal interest in many. In 1899, she even purchases a house at 1224 4th Street, the first home she ever owned. It was a symbolic gesture. She grew to identify so completely with the college that for a while, she considered transferring all of her estate to just the Sophie Newcomb College. Ultimately, still fearing her own relatives, the financial engagement with Tulane was maintained, providing security for Sophie's legacy and the endowment.
Bringing satisfaction to Joe and happiness at last in her life.
Act 4. 2005, in the wake of Hurricane Katrina, Tulane University folds Newcomb Women's College into the coeducational university structure. Newcomb alumni are in an uproar and sue to keep it separate. Using Joe's original endowment letter as primary evidence, the case settles.
To Joe's everlasting tribute, and I paraphrase here from Susan Tucker, Yeah, Tulane got the college, meaning the enrollment, but like a wife in a divorce, Newcomb College Institute got the money. Well, thank you all for coming. Thank you, Catapult, Antenna, Chris, Shadow, Robert, Jarrett, and Steve. Thank you so much, Susan and Beth. You can find all primary sources, the court cases, the letters, at the website, The Letters of Josephine Louise Newcomb. Just Google it. The recording of this performance will be available soon through lettersred.net, all lowercase. The 2024 season is funded primarily by Corner Foundation and a very generous donation from an admiring patron. Additional support is provided by locals like you. To donate, go to lettersred.net/donate and drop a buck in the box on the way out, please. Stay tuned later this year for more of the Newcomb story, a different take on the court case, and another live reading and stuff found along the way to be podcast. Also, beginning in June, Letters Read again partners with the LGBT Plus Archives Project of Louisiana for 4 5-minute mini podcasts about the early days of the HIV/AIDS epidemic here in New Orleans and Louisiana. Thank you.